Such a beautiful sound, right? Moan. Okay. So what I'm hoping to do today are three things. First, I would like to talk to you about grades, grading. This is more or less responsive to your feedback memos. Your feedback memos, a number of you expressed concern that when we'd spoken about grading earlier, we'd had the thought that we'd proceed with some sort of pass-fail, an effort coalesced but never really came into focus, and so far there's been no change. So whatever grading anxiety there was, there still is, and I want to address it. Second, in your feedback memos, some of you expressed some sense that there was weakening of focus, that when we started out, the ideas seemed to be getting clearer, and then with the guests of the last week, it was interesting, but the focus was slightly opaque. And that was, I think, coupled with anxiety expressed in the feedback memos about the uncertainty of the assignment. The memos having been written, obviously, last week before you completed the assignments, and before Rebecca responded with her very articulate email, which I hope was helpful. But nonetheless, this thought of the diffusion of focus, I wanted to address. And then third, halfway through our time today, we have a guest, Rebecca McKinnon, whom I hope will serve to illustrate the focus that I'm hoping to articulate in part two, as well as acquaint you with this remarkable venture that she has been seminal in creating, Global Voices. All right, so these three things. First on grades. You've handed in an assignment. Between now and the end of flyout week, I will get back to you your assignment with some feedback from me. And as good an indication as I can give you of whether I think, hey, this is great, or you haven't got it, or... And I may, if I'm brave enough, actually put that in the form of a grade, an initial grade. I don't want to commit to some percentage of whole or anything like that, because what I'm really looking for out of these assignments is the beginning of a process. Okay, now we've got a document. Now we start. And it's what you do with that that I think is the real test of the class. That is, how well you respond to whatever the feedback is that's offered, and how imaginatively you then carry it on. Now that still leaves you with questions about how I grade. At the end of the day, we will have this assignment, and whatever the fruits of your labors are from this point on through the end in the form of expression in a project, and it'll be that I will be looking at and grading. Now, what are my grading criteria? Somehow it's necessary to say something about it, and yet at the same time make it as clear as I possibly can to you that my grading criteria are entirely subjective. In a sense, what I'm looking for has to do with character. It's character that's expressed. In some sense, the fundamental elements of rhetoric are what I'm looking at and for. I'm looking for the base from which the argument is launched. Hello, Rebecca.
Hey, you've got our email list up on the screen.
I do, it's true. It's true. I'm looking for the ethos, the direction. What is it? Where are you going? And I'm looking for the clarity and imagination and expression. Ultimately, I'm looking for power in the message that comes through. I've thought a fair amount about this in light of the failure of the pass-fail initiative to take shape here. And am prepared to say this to you. I am prepared to rebel against the rule that supposedly binds me to grade according to a curve. I am going to grade according to my sense of how well you've done. And I'm not planning to put it against a mean curve of B plus. Now, at that point, I've said what I have to say on the subject, but I'm happy to respond to questions and reactions. And if there are none, pass on to number two.
Well, I have one. I volunteered to take a C minus for 12 classes.
I appreciate it, KB. I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I strive to earn it.
Excellent. If your level of performance is your notion of a C minus, then I highly respect your scale.
I'd like to say something, actually. It's very surprising to me, although I can understand, given the circumstances, why nobody's speaking up. It's surprising to me that nobody really wants to say something right now. Because having listened to these grading criteria, I expect everybody looks around them and says, everyone in this class has character and the potential to have power. And what does he mean that this standard is entirely subjective? There are all kinds of things that maybe you might not feel very comfortable with in the grading standard that was just proposed to you. So I'm surprised for there to at least be no discussion. Perhaps that's because you guys are all used to a system in which you arrive in a class and are told that you will have a single exam at the end of the semester on which your whole grade will be based and on which you will receive no feedback, no expectations beforehand or feedback after the fact, which to me is the most impoverished grading and evaluation system that I could imagine. So certainly this is better than that. But still, it seems, stand up for yourselves a little bit. Say something about this grading proposal.
I know. I'm just waiting to see how many hands go up. I've got three so far. All right, first come, first served.
The things you're mentioning, such as character, creativity, power, those are things you build up through a lifetime. So, my question to you is that are we sort of stuck with our upbringing, or are you expecting us to somehow improve in the next few weeks in some significant way?
Well, I haven't read your paper yet. And I'm hoping that I can, yes, I'm hoping that I can do something quite significant in the next few weeks.
And what do you suggest our part should be in doing something significant that, we may not have been able to do thus far?
I want you to express yourself. And I want to be the recipient of your expression. I want you to express yourself as powerfully as you can to me, taking off from whatever this point is. And in fact, if this is just a starting point, if you don't like this point, we can talk about some other starting point. By the way, I'm hoping to do regular office hours on Thursday afternoons. And anybody, as you're going along, that feels the need for guidance and collaboration, and totally welcome you to come in. And if you have questions about criteria, just fine. But basically, that's it. Okay. Go.
It seems to me that certain methods for communicating our message are more amenable to being fine-tuned over the course of the semester, perhaps with feedback from you, something like a blog or a wiki or some sort of medium. You know, we may be able to be a little bit more collaborative with you and help develop that character and shape our message, whereas something like a video, you can't really give iterations of a video because it's way too much
work for any one person to do. How do you see that playing into the grading process or not? I'm not really sure. I think each one is going to play in the way it plays, but I haven't got any more particular idea of, you know, differentiating one form of expression from another in terms of some modulating grading methods. Just haven't got it.
We are encouraging a lot of people to do videos, as many of you guys who are up for it. And there are a lot of stages other than the actual video itself that it's possible for you to get feedback on in terms of what you're planning to do in the video, if you have a script, who you're going to talk to in your video, you know, any kind of sort of preparation that you're doing for the video, or even some raw footage, that it's possible for us to sort of get in there with you and take a look at it. And also your group that you're working with is your biggest resource for getting really detailed feedback on the unfinished stages of your projects.
Go.
Okay, well, I'm not sure this is really a challenge to the new Vader system that you outlined. In fact, I think it might be sort of agreeing with it and challenging Rebecca's notion that we should all be anxious at this point. Because it seems like, I mean, it seems to me that for a class like this that's so, nebulously directed, right? Not nebulously put together, but nebulously directed. It's going to go in lots of different directions for everybody. That anything where we were going to, you know, where it was going to be, say, curved on some basis would be, you know, fairly ridiculous. And so I rather like the idea that, you know, I don't know if character is the criterion on which I want to be solely judged or something like that, but I think, I mean, the possibility that, you know, as Rebecca said, we all have character, everybody in this room probably has character and power in the way they get their points across and what have you, and that, you know, without a curve, I think there's not a whole lot of need for anxiety about that, so everybody does well.
And let me clarify. I really meant to clarify as I was going along. I think the power of message is more character as a component. It's not the whole deal. It's like you make a message, I get it, and wham, I give you a grade. It's like
works for me.
Works for you. All right. So now, I think that with Rebecca here, I will, in a way, merge what I wanted to say with focus and with my introduction of her. This is Cyber One, Law in the Court of Public Opinion. The metaphor that Becca and I wanted to pursue from the beginning was of a courtroom metaphor in some way, taken up to the next level. And if you follow the metaphor through, the way in which a court proceeding begins is with a complaint. And so it is a focusing question to ask with respect to the issue that you've engaged, how would one make a complaint in the court of public opinion? Suppose I want to file a complaint in the court of public opinion. And I want to do it in a way that takes advantage of its cyber quality. Hey, Alex, you're going to have to come down front because I actually need you. You. Here, come sit over here. All right, now, just by way of piecing Rebecca into the puzzle, Rebecca has created this cyber environment called Global Voices. It's a construction. And within that construction, she has successfully launched complaints in the court of public opinion and has become masterful at the use of the techniques of advancing complaint in the court of public opinion. So in terms of providing for us some ability to focus the thoughts that have been afoot from the beginning, I'm looking forward to talking with her specifically about complaints that she's launched and how she's done it. But I have a specific complaint that I want to put to her as a possible example on which she could advise me. I have a complaint that I'm eager to launch in the court of public opinion. It has to do with work that I've done over the years in Jamaica. Various people have touched it in one way or the other. Rebecca spent, how long did you spend?
6 months.
6 months living in Kingston. Doing music workshops and computer workshops in high schools and prisons. Mary and Diane participated with me just last week in an interview with Father Albert, who's one of the leading Catholic personages in Jamaica who runs a tremendous charitable operation. Alex and Diane both participated in a series of interviews in the prisons as part of generating a video handbook for new people coming into the prison system as inmates and their families. And still a work in progress, but very interesting. And then I undertook, with a newly formed organization in Jamaica, the Public Broadcasting Corporation of Jamaica, to make a series of programs for them, produced by Destiny Studios, which is a small studio operation run by the person who runs our prison-associated program down there. The first program we made was to be aired as the inaugural program for PBCJ. They were just going to be starting up. They were going to run for a week and rerun the same program for a week, then desist broadcast and begin again middle of October, very shortly. The first program that we made was on the subject of emancipation and independence. Jamaica was emancipated from slavery in 1838. They got their independence from Great Britain in 1962. And they celebrate emancipation and independence on the 1st of August each year. And this first program that we did was a roundtable discussion on the subject of emancipation and independence, in which the thesis that emerged in the program was that, well, first the frame after the colon on the title, Emancipation and Independence, Is Jamaica Really Free? And this was moderated by Kevin Wallen, who is the head of our program down there. And the structure of the program was that Jamaica starts as a colonial island, owned by the British and exploited for sugar primarily, with a plantation slavery system, brutal. That it starts with a white guy with a whip and black slaves. And then the white guy figures out that if he privileges the black guy, one of them, the most compliant of them, give them the whip and some extra privilege, that he can retire to the porch. Let the black guy do the whipping. The next stage that happened in Jamaica was something called the War of the Maroons. The Maroons were slaves that had run away to the hills and lived free in the mountains. And it was a tremendous problem for the British because slaves would run away and join the Maroons. It was like a hole in the bottom of the cup. So they went to war with the Maroons. Eventually, after an amazing long time, they brought the Maroons to their knees and forced them to sign a treaty in which the Maroons were given the choice of getting wiped out or alternatively having their freedom but becoming the slave police. And they became the slave police. So it's like the white guy backs up one more step. Now we've got the black guys as the police on the slaves. And then as the colonial process goes forward, the British educate various Jamaicans to become lawyers, to start being the administrative structure. And eventually it comes up to 1962 when Great Britain's ready to devolve the government to the Jamaicans. They get the Jamaicans to adopt a constitution that's suitable to the British Parliament, and they then grant Jamaica their independence. And they back up one more step. Now we're trading partners and various other relations. But the idea of this program is that the structures that were originally put in place, the fundamental structures of education, of criminal justice, of religion, basically things didn't change much. All right, you're not a slave in an ownership sense. Now you're a wage employee. But the plantations still continue to look pretty much the same. And the education system, initially designed to just train a population to serve and be docile, still, you see it. And the criminal justice system hasn't changed a bit. And so the thesis of the program was that, all right, we're 40 years into independence. The original constitution was adopted for purposes of getting free, but we were not a free people when we established it. Now's the time to reconstitute. We followed up that program with the recording of a second program at which Alex was at the center of the table. And to her left was P.J. Patterson, the recently retired Prime Minister of Jamaica. And to her right was Edward Seaga, the Prime Minister who preceded P.J. Patterson. So there you have both and all of the living past Prime Ministers of Jamaica. And the subject of the program was constitutional reform. The thesis of the program, time for Jamaica to reconstitute itself. Well, here's my complaint. We finished and delivered emancipation and independence. It, in fact, was shown as the inaugural program of PCBJ, which sounds like a bigger deal than it was. They didn't have a transmitter. And so what they did was they actually bought time on other stations, ran the program. They were planning to run it for a week. And people really didn't get that good notice of where they could be found. And so it didn't make any significant impact. And the guy who ran PCBJ as its chairman, the Reverend Neville Callum, was offended by the thesis of the program. Thought it was too negative. Particularly didn't like the part about religion, in which Kevin said he really didn't understand why it was so important to have church as an intermediary to God, that he thought people should have a direct relationship to God, and if the churches were there, be there in support. But they shouldn't be telling you what to believe. Reverend Callum yanked the program. We have not heard anything further from them. In fact, although not only did he yank the program, but he fired the chief executive that they had hired and with whom we'd been dealing at PCBJ. Not clear that it's related. And we haven't had any word or been able to get any word from them as to further delivery or further activity. All right, so I'm upset about this. And I would like to seek some remedy for this. I would like to file a complaint in the court of public opinion. The question is, what would that mean? What are we talking about here? What would be a complaint in the court of public opinion? How would one bring it to attention? Well, along the way, I spoke to John Palfrey. I asked John, how would you do it, John? What would be a complaint in the court of public opinion? And he thought for a moment. Well, you think for a moment. Tell me, what do you think would be a way to proceed? How could we go about making a complaint in the court of public opinion, looking to somehow bring it to focus in a way that somehow produced the effect that one wants? What is the effect that I would like? I would love to see, as a result of the filing of the complaint in the court of public opinion, the entire island of Jamaica and its diaspora tune in to the fact that now would be a wonderful time to think about reconstituting. I'd love to see the idea that's at the core of the program succeed. I'd love to have people really curious to know what this program was that the Reverend Callum censored, and really eager to hear the continuation of thought from the former prime ministers. Now, here's what you have to work with. Here's what I have to work with. Me, basically. I'm going to Jamaica during the flyout week. I can do whatever it would make sense to do. I have the net. I can write. I have the resources that we've seen. So, now, come. complaint in the court of public opinion. Yes?
Does it make sense to start out with what you want to achieve? Like, we could put out some of the elements of how long you have, what you want to achieve, and because I'm just wondering and how much you're willing to put into it. Like, it seems to me you need a leader, or you need some way to, somebody on the ground who's going to really carry this through, who has the authority to tell the story you want to tell. And I don't know if a week in Jamaica does it, or if you already have it.
I have, for storytellers, I have potentially myself, Kevin Wallen, who leads Destiny Productions. I have Alex and Diane. Diane was down there immediately following. I have the people who were my guests at our guests, Kevin and mine, at that first program, which includes a popular talk show host. Kevin himself has two programs a week on community radio in Kingston, one of which will be available for something I could participate in and he could do.
Could you take out an ad? Would you be willing to take out an ad, like a video ad?
I don't want to spend money. I don't want to buy it.
So let me just jump in and just make sure that we're clear on what you're saying here. Is that what you want to start off with is some kind of a plan that includes a clear statement of the goals and what the resources are that you have at the beginning.
Well, my first thought was you should take out an ad, but I didn't know if it's already beyond the means. I was thinking you should create your own, you should censor yourself is what I was thinking. If you could create a piece of If you could start to tell your story and then censor it and get people wondering about why it's being censored, why the story is so important that it would be censored.
All right, that's a thought. Let's get, see hands, I want to just get lots of thoughts in. Yes, go.
I guess my suggestion is a little less specific and just more about how to approach it in general. I think the most difficult thing about this, this is obvious, but I think it's important to say it and realize that this is the biggest hurdle so you can think good and hard about how to fix it. The problem is that people need a reason to care about this. And this is, we're dealing with the internet generation, we're dealing with people with fruit fly attention spans. And I think you need to come up with a specific strategy for why people will care. I think there are a bunch of different ways you could do it. I mean, for instance, you could try and find someone who people listen to already for one reason or another, which may actually include yourself, and use a sort of testimonial approach. People are already listening to this person, they already read his blog, and they lend credence, they give credibility to what he says, go that approach. Or you could find an existing community of people on the net who already care about this sort of thing, message boards, or whatever, for people whose interests already lie in this direction, and try and use that as a basis. Or you could...
Okay, wonderful customer. This is good. Listen, I'm going to go with three more. Then I want to go with Rebecca. And then I want to save some time after I've talked to Rebecca about what she's doing to come back to this. So just three more. Yeah.
Well, one other difficulty going along with that is the level of internet penetration in Jamaica. I just looked at this site, internetworldstats.com, whose reliability I can't independently vouch for. But for Jamaica, it lists about a 40% internet penetration rate compared to about 70% in the U.S.
I would be amazed if it was that high.
That kind of brings to the point. You said you didn't want to spend any money on this, which means, the internet and blogging and posting seems like a likely avenue. But if it only reaches a relatively small percentage of the population, but that's a presumably more affluent and influential part of the population, maybe your goal could be is you're not going to spend any of your money on it, but if you can get it out to a lot of people who care, who would be willing to donate, time, effort, and funds into it, the internet, I think, might be better in that respect than in getting it to everybody directly.
All right, good. Go.
Well, to me, stating a complaint starts with stating your story and stating the facts. You already have a video, which was... seems like it would be have a strong impact. And if you're trying to reach Jamaicans of the diaspora, you've got a huge amount of them here in America, huge amount of them in London, if you could get your video to those avenues, BBC or public access here in the States, and let people of the diaspora get angry and upset, and then, you know, a little tail at the end, like, this was censored and it wasn't shown in Jamaica, even though everyone else is seeing it. Let the international community get mad. They've got some money that they're sending back. Let them get upset. And I'm sure you could at least get it shown on some kind of station there.
Very good. Yes.
You want to create guilt or persuasion, I think you have to find the tactic, because, or you can use both, but maybe writing an op-ed page in the New York Times talking about it will get the Jamaican media interested and saying, you know, what is this? And then they will show it on the news, like the video that you have.
Diane, I'm back.
Engaging the interest of students, and then like maybe having them brainstorm ideas of how they can get involved, so that people feel like they have control over it, that have ownership over it, and they'll be more interested in spreading the message.
Rebecca, come on down.
Can I plug my...
You can plug in here. Yes, we have a nice selector. All right, so the segue here is pretty clean. Kevin Wallen and I went to a Global Voices conference in London that Rebecca and Ethan Zuckerman, her partner in crime, were very much a part of. What is Global Voices? Rebecca will tell you more, but I have up here on the screen, well, was on the screen, and I'm sure you took a look at it, the daily email that comes out from Global Voices, giving you a synopsis of the highlights. Now, what is Global Voices? The world net that David Laser showed us. Global Voices recognizes that each language group is effectively its own small world, and is premised on the idea that if you establish what Rebecca and Ethan called bridge bloggers in a community environment where they could support and relate to each other, you would effectively be linking small worlds. That's exactly what Global Voices is.
Scrolling through it while you're talking.
Right. So, Rebecca, when did you get the idea for doing this, and how did it come into being?
Sure. Well, basically, this came out of a meeting we had roughly 2 years ago now, also here at Harvard, that Ethan and I tacked on the end of an Internet and Society conference. And I'm a journalist by background. I worked for CNN in China for 9 years and in Japan for 2.5, and covered a lot of other parts of Asia. And I came to Harvard initially on leave from my job, and then kind of quit my job, partially because I was frustrated with the direction CNN was going in, because I felt that CNN was doing more to reinforce stereotypes between countries than to bridge gaps of understanding between people in different countries, but also because I was really fascinated with what's happening on the web. And this relates to how Global Voices got going, and I'll talk a bit about Ethan's motivation. But the fact that you no longer, if you are in Kenya or if you are in Jamaica or if you are in Malaysia, and you would like people in the outside world to recognize your issues or understand your perspectives, used to be that basically you had to wait till a journalist found your life interesting enough or your perspective interesting enough to interview you and quote you in the international media or put your soundbite on CNN or something. Otherwise, it was very, very difficult to get attention for your perspectives. But thanks to the internet and thanks to the web 2.0 as it's evolved, so that people can self-publish with pretty much the same ease that it takes to write an email, you're seeing people taking matters into their own hands. And one of the earliest example of bridge bloggers is a guy who you guys might have heard of. His pen name is Salam Pax. He was known as the Baghdad blogger. And in the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, he was blogging. You know, he just set up a free account on blogspot.com. And in the run-up to Iraq, he was describing his life living in Baghdad in the run-up to the U.S. bombing Baghdad, and then as the invasion started and so on, describing what it was like to be living through those times, not from the perspective of some professional journalist kind of knowing all the professional details, but just this is my personal experience, and this is how U.S. policy and the diplomacy and statesmanship is affecting me and the people in my neighborhood. And that was very powerful, and he began to have quite a bit of impact, I think, on a lot of people's perception of what was happening. And so I became very interested in studying how basically professionals' loss of control over information might affect our perceptions of the rest of the world and the ability of people to kind of take their messages into their own hands and not be so dependent on professional media to mediate their messages, the disintermediation. Meanwhile, Ethan is a specialist in Africa, and he had created something called Blog Africa, and basically was very interested in the fact that the international media pays very little attention to Africa, yet increasing numbers of people from Africa and living in Africa were setting up their own blogs, and this is one by somebody who used to be a student here, Oreo Kolo, who is now the Kenyan pundit. And again, taking matters into their own hands, saying, okay, the international media is ignoring us, or if they do pay attention to us, they're mainly just talking about AIDS and war and so on. We have a lot of other things going on that the international media doesn't pay attention to. We can now get our own message out. And so this development of bridge bloggers, what did this mean? So we brought together, basically we got a little funding, and we brought about a dozen or so bloggers, what we call bridge bloggers, from different parts of the world, people who were writing online, self-publishing, with an eye to the idea that they wanted to communicate to a larger audience and communicate the conversations that were happening online in their own countries and bridge them to the rest of the world because they happen to be multilingual or more articulate or have a bit more of a global perspective and sort of have the ability to talk to the international community in a language that people from outside their own country would understand. So we had this meeting and we were kind of talking about, so how do we connect these dots? There are people doing this all over the world. How do you amplify the most interesting voices, the people who really want to be heard and who deserve to be heard? How do bridge bloggers in different countries support one another? And basically, Global Voices emerged out of that, where we now have a team of about a dozen, we call them regional editors, and they are bridge bloggers, major bridge bloggers from the different regions, and they aggregate every day. They'll kind of select what they feel are the most interesting blog posts coming out of their region on any given day. So, for instance, in this middle column here, you have what our editor, our America's editor, feels are some of the most interesting blog posts coming out of the Americas, East Asia, and so on. And then we have, in the left-hand column, a more in-depth feature section where we're trying to do two things. One is we have people translating blogs from other languages. So we have people translating sort of the major buzz from blogs in the Middle East, in Arabic, in Persian. We also have translations of blog buzz from Chinese, Spanish, Portuguese, and French. So basically the idea is that this is not an effort to replace the Associated Press or Reuters News Agency in terms of what's happening outside North America and Western Europe. But this is an effort to help people get a window onto and perhaps participate in this global conversation that is taking place online and to try and get a hook into it, because there's so much cacophony all around the world. How do you know who are the interesting bridge bloggers from any given country unless you're kind of from that country and know the bloggers in that country? It's really hard to get a hold on. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to kind of be your guide every day. We're trying to curate or moderate this conversation in
so
a way
now,
that's
Rebecca,
happening.
You have filed a complaint in the court of public opinion.
A little bit. Actually, just trying to have a conversation. You know, I don't know if we necessarily view this as a complaint. Although I guess to some extent it is, because we feel that the international media is kind of broken, and this is sort of a response.
Well, I wasn't thinking of Global Voices itself being a complaint.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking of the campaign that you've waged with respect to the behavior of American companies in China.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, basically, I've sort of been sucked into a whole debate about American corporate responsibility vis-a-vis Chinese internet censorship. I lived in China for a very long time. I read Chinese. So after I came here to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, I started paying a great deal of attention to what is happening on the internet in China. And what became clear as I started looking at the way in which the internet gets censored in China is that there's a great... The Chinese government and its system of censorship would not function without a lot of corporate complicity. And this corporate complicity is not just coming from Chinese companies who are forced to censor content on search engines and blog hosting sites and chat rooms in order not to lose their licenses, but Google goes in and censors its content, and Yahoo goes in, offers a Chinese language email service, and then hands people over to the police as requested. And so on and so forth. Microsoft taking down Chinese blogs based on political complaints from the authorities. And so I've gotten involved with basically a very public conversation and debate that's going on about the role of technology companies in places like China, but really also really globally, when you have governments here. I have a slide which I didn't prepare, but basically there's sort of governments up there, companies in the middle, and the individual down there. And with internet and telecoms companies, increasingly, because so much of our identity and our ability to communicate and our very being increasingly is caught up in these online services we use and the other telecom services we use, When those companies are caught in a conflict of interest where the government of the country you live in has a certain set of interests, and they're asking that the company comply with that set of interests, but compliance with those set of interests goes against your own personal interests and your personal human rights, universally recognized, where do those companies stand? Where do they come down? And this issue is thrown into perhaps strongest relief in China, because China is both an incredibly lucrative market and is also a clearly authoritarian state. But this question is prevalent everywhere in the world, and certainly in the United States as well. So the discussion is really, as Western and multinational companies go into China and make these decisions about where they stand in between the individual and government, what kinds of precedents is this setting for their behavior globally? And is this going to also have blowback implications for how those companies treat us here?
All right. Now, I'm not so interested.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested, don't get me wrong, but it's not my focus here. Mm-hmm. What the substance of your argument was, what the substance of your complaint was. But I'm very interested in how you've prosecuted it. How did you put out the word?
Mm-hmm.
How did you create the buzz?
Right.
How did you get the court of public opinion to pay attention to your complaint?
I'll show you the blog post.
Hello.
So this blog post that I posted in early January about Microsoft's takedown of a particular Chinese blog ended up being the number one most linked blog post that day in the blogosphere, according to blog polls. And the reason was because I had some unique information. It was a very hot topic and controversial topic. I knew a lot of the kind of famous bloggers. I emailed everybody. Everybody started linking to it. It kind of created a viral conversation across the internet, which eventually caused this issue among many to I think, get more attention in the press. And, yeah, so it was very interesting. I used to be a correspondent for CNN, but perhaps I think one of the issues I've had the most impact on in my entire journalistic career is something that I blogged, not something that I did a TV story on.
All right, so now go slower. Go, KB.
Sure.
I think I know what he's going to say. Your explanation is kind of unacceptable for us because your explanation...
That wasn't what I was going to say.
Okay, well, for me, it's unacceptable for me because your explanation seems to be I was plugged into the network. I knew
sure.
the right people.
Yeah.
And that's how I got it. But, I mean, how does that help us?
That's a very good question. Yeah, because absolutely. There are a lot of people out there who have really interesting things to say who don't get heard because they don't know the right people to hook into. So, yeah, it's not just about publishing and putting it out there. It's how you link up to the people who are going to pay attention to you. And that really brings us back to Global Voices in a way, because what we're trying to do with Global Voices, I'm not completely, I'll kind of come back to this as well, but what we're trying to do with Global Voices is there are all these people out there who are pointing out things that are not getting in the media otherwise. And they're not, these people are not hooked up with powerful networks who know people in the New York Times. But we've created a vehicle that we know the New York Times follows. And so by linking to these people, we are starting to get stuff that bloggers talked about from Zimbabwe and from Malaysia noticed by the New York Times and the BBC and the Guardian and other media organizations because we've hooked them into this network. And personally, sort of, I can create my own network because I'm one of those few people who is in a position to do so.
But let me follow up. Let me follow up, KB.
But you know, I guess part of it is your strategy for hooking into a network that can amplify your conversation. And also, I think we need more networks built that will help amplify conversations in this way. I don't know if I really answered your question.
Well, but I wanted to follow up on KB's behalf. When you say you sent out email to, all right, you sent out email to, and he says, well, but you had a network. And he says, well, how would I do that? Here I am. I'm out there in the world. I'm a node.
Right.
I'm interested in KB's subject.
Mm-hmm.
We relate. We go to Burning Man together. Who knows? And he does his research, and he makes up a list of people who are out there that might be interested in his subject.
Absolutely.
Does he just send them all, like spend his life writing emails to them? Or?
Well, I mean, the other thing is when you're – there's such thing as developing a blogging strategy for gaining influence. So, for instance, you're writing about something that is of great interest to people within, say – the Burning Man network of people, you know, just for instance. And perhaps there are some people you know some other people who know some other people who kind of by passing information along will get you a lot of attention.
Six degrees of separation.
Yeah, so in part, you know, you never send emails out to people who barely know you and expect that that's going to be very useful, and in most cases that'll just cause you to be permanently in their spam folders. But what you do is you say, okay, I've written this thing, and perhaps you link back through your blog post to other people who've written about similar subjects in your post, because that then sends a track back through the blogging software, so they know that you linked to them, and then they'll go read what you said, and then they might comment on it, and in that way, their readers will go to you. So that's one way of doing it. The other is to
go slower on that one and go over it again.
Sure.
I mean, we're talking methodology.
Sure, methodology. Let me see if I have a good example in this post.
Basically, KB, I'm out there in internet land,
yeah.
And I've got my own little blog, see?
Right.
And I love it. I check Technorati to see whether anybody's linked to it 3 times a day,
mm-hmm.
Right?
And all the major bloggers who care about their traffic are checking Technorati to see.
3 times a day. And anybody that links, I go and check, see what they said.
I'll show you Technorati, yeah. But also what happens is, this is Technorati, and this is a way to check and see who's linking to you. And you can put in your URL there and see. But the other way you can find out, let me go down and I'll show you an example of trackback. And this is how the blogosphere basically works, in that people are linking to one another. It's not that you're just writing an essay and you're linking to nobody and it gets attention. That rarely is how it works unless you're incredibly famous. But for instance, I linked to Robert Scoble, who is a well-known guy who used to work for Microsoft, who used to blog. Every time I link to him, I know that he's going to see that I linked to him, and then he's going to go and look at and see what I said about him. Then he's likely to respond to it on his blog, thus driving his readers to my blog. And so it kind of goes back and forth like that. So here is trackback. So I can see here there's some people who linked to me, including this guy, Junkyard Blog, whatever that is. No idea who he is. Or I've got too many tabs up, but at any rate, I can see who has been linking to me, and then I can go back and see what comments they made about this post I wrote, and that way I know that they exist. I might not have known that they exist. Then I might link to them, and that kind of generates attention amongst people. So it's kind of a complicated strategy of both emailing people you know who you think will care about what you've written enough to tell their friends to read it.
Plus, but not email people who are going to take it as spam.
Right.
So it's exactly. Not, that's not a blunt instrument.
People, it's a very subtle instrument. And you only use it with people who are really going to read your email. Combined with looking at what other bloggers have written on your subject, particularly some of the bloggers who you know are influential in that field, making sure that when you're writing something that you may have exclusively that they don't know about, but maybe they wrote on something related. You might sort of make a little acknowledgement, say, so-and-so wrote about something similar last week where he said such-and-such, but I think this argument, linking to him, but I think this argument, adds some new things for such-and-such reason, then so-and-so is going to see you link to him and go, oh, this guy, seems to have something new on this. I better go check it out. And he's going to want to link to you because he has value on his blog by giving his readers links to new things that they wouldn't otherwise know. Because one of the big reasons people read blogs, particularly of their friends, is because those blogs will send them places that they wouldn't have found otherwise and point them to new sources of information they wouldn't have otherwise. So that's kind of how you, it's how you build sort of a viral network in a way.
Before Becca, let me just ask one more question. Do you tag your blogs?
It depends on what software you're using, because I use a software called TypePad, which has a category system. And this is really technical, but it has a category system, whereas if I assign it a category, that automatically creates a Technorati tag, which automatically causes it to appear on that tag page in TechNarchive.
So if you were advising KB on going for maximum buzz on whatever his issue was.
Yeah, you want to make sure you want to make sure you label, you know, you either put a category or a Technorati tag on the subject that you care about. I'll show you Technorati here again. So this is Technorati, and so there's this thing called tags. So if you want to see everything that anybody's written, oh, let's see, what's a good hot issue today, you know, so everybody's written on Foley, say, you know, just to be really boring. You know, so this is everybody who's deliberately gone and flagged their blog posts as being about Foley, and it all shows up here. And then you can also see, okay, here's a bunch of people who tagged their blog posts about Hastert. And so by doing this, they are deliberately trying to get everybody interested in blogs on Hastert to find your particular blog so that it will kind of go into this universe that people will be able to find. And so there are a lot of journalists now who are starting to use Technorati as a tool for finding interesting people who have interesting things to say on the subjects they follow. So it's very likely that, for instance, on Foley, that there may be some journalists who follow that issue, who have been following that story, who will go and check out the Technorati tag for Foley and see what various bloggers have been saying to see if there's any new juice that's come out and been leaked on some blog and so on. And this is one way people dig around for information. So it's a way of kind of flagging that you're part of this conversation and you want to be noticed.
Rebecca Nesson.
I just wanted to push back a little in the other direction on KB's question and just think for a second about what kind of resources we do have in terms of figuring out how to create the networks around us. There are some of them that are very explicitly because of this course. The course has gotten a whole lot of attention just for existing, and maybe part of the reason that it's gotten so much attention is because it's here at Harvard, and all of you guys are people who are here at Harvard. That's already a huge leg up over most of people who are out there trying to get attention on something in the world. Then on top of that, you guys have picked projects that are in some sense related to something that you're passionate about, probably because you have some experience with it and some relationships with some other people who care about that same issue. And maybe it's not going to be something as big as changing the way multinational corporations function in an international market, but you may have enough energy focused from this course, from your own identity, from your own contacts, to generate a fair amount of buzz using just the same strategies that Rebecca was using.
Absolutely.
All right, so Rebecca, have you got any advice for me on my Jamaica problem?
Yeah, that's a good question because, I mean, there is a Jamaican blogosphere. Our Caribbean editor covers it. It's not huge from what I understand. Georgia Popplewell, who's from Trinidad, is our Caribbean editor, and she could tell you, you could probably tell us, much more than I can about the specifics of the Jamaican blogosphere, but there certainly are Jamaican blogs. It does sound like in terms of, again, it's who you're trying to influence with this debate. Are you trying to influence the Jamaican public discourse domestically, or are you trying to influence the Jamaican diaspora, or are you trying to influence the international policy community that's interested in Jamaica more generally? And I would say
one, two, and three, just the way you lined it
right
up.
Because if you're interested in influencing the domestic discourse within Jamaica, I would say probably internet penetration is not nearly high enough that blogging would be your number one strategy in influencing the public. That probably radio and other media might be more influential. However, that said, we are seeing examples, and actually Ori Okolo in Kenya is an example of somebody who, in a country where most people do not have internet connectivity, she and a community of Kenyan bloggers have managed to have a substantial impact on the Kenyan media by watchdogging the Kenyan media and becoming media critics and pointing out where they're failing to report certain things or where they appear to be going really soft on, you know, Kabila's wife or, you know, so on and so on. And while most ordinary Kenyans cannot read blogs and don't know what blogs are and are not on the internet, the elites are, and the journalists are to enough of an extent that the criticism that's been coming out of the Kenyan blogosphere of the Kenyan media has caused the Kenyan media to be much more on its toes about sloppy and corrupt reporting. And so that's been a very interesting impact you know, again, there's mass influence and then there's elite influence. And it does seem that elite influence does manage to have an impact. It also does seem that where you have large diaspora communities who are online, viral videos on YouTube and this kind of thing can have an impact if you tie, you know, you figure out, so with the Jamaican diaspora, what websites do they use? And what conversation, you know, it might not be blogs, it might be bulletin boards. It may be that posting links to YouTube videos in the right bulletin boards that are frequented by Jamaican diaspora might be the way to influence. I have a friend who's actually in marketing, but who is very involved with a site called Crick Info. It's a global cricket information site. And what has been pointed out to me is that this site happens to be a place where people from all the cricket-playing countries on Earth not only go for cricket information, but end up having political discussions and passing around all kinds of information.
All the cricket-playing countries on Earth is like a one-to-one correspondence with British colonialism.
Right. Sorry?
Not the U.S.
Not the U.S.
Right. And not really Canada so much either for some reason. But yeah, and so, for instance, my colleague from Trinidad says that Crick Info has huge amounts of influence in Trinidad and the Trinidadian diaspora because everybody's following that site. So, and then the diaspora ends up having impact on the elite's conversation, not necessarily so much the grassroots, but you know they know people in the press, and you know they're sending. They economically have impact, and et cetera, et cetera. And so, how do you, you know, it's kind of figuring out strategically where you generate buzz in certain communities by figuring out kind of what media presences these communities are using. So, actually, another suggestion, which just off the top of my head. There is a fairly new organization called New American Media, which is based out of the Bay Area. And what they do is their site aggregates content from ethnic media all over the United States, which, of course, includes diaspora publications and diaspora websites and diaspora, you know, radio stations from, you know, all over the world of communities that have sort of critical mass in various cities in the United States. And so it may be that, you know, that might be a way to find a way to tie into, you know, Jamaican diaspora media communities in certain cities in the United States.
On your complaint,
that might,
Rebecca,
talk about this.
On your complaint about China,
mm-hmm.
Did you do media interviews yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, people found me through my blog, and I ended
once
up doing
the blog lit it up, then
yeah,
other
yeah.
media
I
starts
got,
to
I
gather around.
I got a lot of calls from a lot of journalists, and kind of ended up becoming one of the people that people would kind of turn to for
quotes.
For quotes, yes, for sound bites and
quotes.
And all that kind of thing.
Can I ask you a question about your project?
Yes, please.
So,
this comes from the feedback also. This seems like maybe the most inappropriate of the cyber projects that I could imagine, because you're talking about something where it's got a revolutionary quality to it. You want people to basically realize that they're in the situation in which they haven't taken control of their own destiny and write a constitution that gives people more rights for themselves. And you're bringing this message in from the outside. The diaspora community is not one that necessarily has huge influence in Jamaica, particularly because of the sensitivity about hegemony from the United States and all kinds of outside influence. And then you have maybe some strategies for influencing elites in Jamaica who, like Father Callum, are the least likely to be interested in this message because it threatens their own positions of power in the society. Mm. So how could this be a cyber project?
Well, let me step back a bit. First of all, you're totally right that the idea of coming in from the outside with something is not the way to go. And the Berkman Center has at least tried valiantly in almost everything it's done to be an amplifier rather than an originator of ideas in foreign environments. So, for instance, Global Voices is really coming up from the distributed area rather than somehow being delivered down. That's equally true with this. This is a project that originates out of Destiny, which is Kingston, with Kevin Wallen as the host of it, and with the prime ministers of the country, past prime ministers, in support of the idea, and the people who are advancing it being Jamaican entirely. I'm there, it's true. I'm there as kind of a guy who is into internet amplification of interesting stuff. It's also not radical in exactly the sense that you talk about. It's not more rights that I'm interested in. It's rather the idea of using a philosophy of self-development that involves integration of identity in order to promote development, both at the individual and the national level. And so the idea, I would be perfectly happy if a reconstituted Jamaica adopted exactly the same constitution that they had before, if it was a true expression of the country. What I can see, what everybody in Jamaica sees, is these huge divisions in the society that you can track back to the pressures of colonialism in many respects, which are at the moment leaving the society in a state of tremendously opposed tensions and a flat development since their independence. And so the idea of identifying issues, establishing an environment in which they can be spoken about in empathic ways, and using the media, integrated media, internet at the center, but radio in Jamaica far more important than internet, and newspaper, extremely important in Jamaica.
Cable television,
extremely important. Using all of the media, but having some sense of internet as a potential integrator and distributor to a global diaspora environment, that's very much the idea. You use that as the environment in which to integrate issues that divide identity, and by integrating identity, make a much stronger Jamaica.
Yes.
But extrapolated from Jamaica to individuals in other places. That's the strategy.
Now this reminds me of a conversation we've had with some of the folks involved with Global Voices and also with other people in the human rights and development community about the role of outsiders and the extent to which technology might enable outsiders to step back a bit more. In the case of China, there's often a lot of pushback. You know, what business do you foreigners have trying to figure out or trying to have any say in what our future should be? And, you know, go away. one often gets that message. And one hears this from a lot of countries. Yet, on the other hand, people would love help getting their voices heard. And to what extent In the old model of human rights advocacy or development advocacy, it was always that development groups or human rights groups generally run by very well-meaning liberal Americans and Europeans would go and work in some third world country and kind of aggregate the voices of and the needs and the interests of the people locally and amplify those up to the rest of the world. But oftentimes you would have Westerners speaking on behalf of people in developed countries. And thanks to new technology, increasingly, you can step back a bit more, we're finding. And it's interesting because I've done some work with Human Rights Watch, which is still fairly much on the old model, and the extent to which people need to step back a bit more and just let people locally speak and to help facilitate the platforms on which people locally can get their voices out directly. And it's a very, very interesting challenge that we've been noticing in a number of different communities. I mean, the fact that a dissident's wife in China, the wife or a sister of a dissident who's been jailed can now publish directly to the web and get her family's stories out. She's not necessarily depending on Westerners to mediate that. And what does that mean? And how does that change the role of those people from the privileged and developed world in facilitating a court of public opinion in different ways? And I'd be curious to hear other people's opinion on that.
All right, the floor is open. Alex.
Well, I think also to Rebecca's point, in the example you just gave, if a woman of the developing world is speaking, using the internet or whatever media to speak out on her stand, and she's not having a chance to voice those concerns to people who are living like her. Because, I mean, when she makes that kind of plea, it's going out to the Western world, who in return gets mobilized and excited and comes back and tries to help. So I wonder what the media did in that instance. Because still, although she's been empowered and her voice is being heard, how much does that voice help her in her empowerment of her situation and the situation of people? And I was actually getting into that debate in college. We used to always talk about who has the right to speak for a people and who has the right to go and, you know, get on the ground level. And it's a very tough issue. But I think it is a start for someone to at least be able to speak about it. And I think that's stating your claim in the court of public opinion is stating the facts and getting your story out. But then how it's settled and what the remedy is a whole other story.
Who acts as your advocate.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's true.
The screen keeps going off.
So I just had a question that we're a lot lately we've been talking about using the internet and cyberspace to get your voice out, to facilitate communication, and to get your message heard, which is, you know, what's going on here. Then we've been tasked with something a step beyond that, which is taking a message, making it persuasive to another audience, and then making something happen in the world, like making some change occur, starting with a message, getting it out through a cyber medium, and then rallying people to your cause and actually changing something in someone's life. And so one thing that I've been looking for, curious about, is whether we have any examples or precedents of people who've done this. I mean, someone who had an idea or a cause, started in a cyber medium, and actually accomplished it in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for both for you and Professor Nesson if we have some precedents.
Within a five-week time frame.
Fundraising. I mean,
that. Money, we can do that.
I mean, I know some small Chinese NGOs, you know, operating in a environment that's not really that friendly officially to independent non-governmental organizations. That there's this one Chinese, basically, non-governmental organization created by a group of bloggers who decided they wanted to do their little bit to help poor children in a remote rural county. And so they created this blog that was called, basically it means Carry One Extra Kilogram was the title of the blog. And the idea was is that they were trying to get people to go visit this county and bring an extra kilogram of books or other things that were on a list of things that the school children needed, or to donate money or something like that. And they didn't have the ability to raise funds themselves. But through doing this, they have managed to provide some, to basically get enough people to go and help this, you know, county and the school children in this county that has made a difference on some people's lives that might not necessarily have happened otherwise. But a lot of time it's in smaller things. It's I've listened in on some of your previous lectures about this issue of, you know, to what extent is the internet and internet communication really changing politics? To what extent is policy being changed as a result, and that kind of thing? And it tends to be much more amorphous and nonlinear, and that's, I think, sometimes might be a bit of a challenge in a very short-term project, in that it's really hard, I've been finding, in a lot of things I've been involved with online, to trace the direct path between cause and effect, that you get sort of aggregate conversations and lots of people doing various things and reacting to something in different ways that you may or may not ever know about, but contributes in aggregate to some decision getting made or people deciding to show up in a particular place. You certainly have examples in a number of places. The Kefaya movement, which is the opposition pro-democracy movement in Egypt, organizes demonstrations through blogs. And so, again, there were in China, there was a series of anti-Japanese riots that were organized through blogs. So, I mean, that's another example of, you know, a result you could try to achieve. I don't know.
So one thing that was amazing to me as I got started doing stuff in the cyber medium wasn't so much the ability to trace the effect, but the ability to feel the energy that came back when I did something, that you can put something out there, put a little effort into it, and then discover that there are real people who have taken interest in what you've done and will get together at some place or do some activity and bring their energy into your project. Then it's a whole other step to figure out how to really channel that to make change. But if you guys get to the point where you just can get that thing where there's the influx of energy around your idea and something that you're giving to people that's satisfying to them in return for their energy, that would be a big success. And some examples of that have been really impressive to me, maybe I'll just say one is really impressive. An organization that at the time was called Downhill Battle, which you could probably find at downhillbattle.org, was upset about a particular music sampling case in which a particular three notes from a song were sampled, and in a way that was, you know, it was not an important part of the song, and it was sampled in a way that was not particularly recognizable. And the judge basically said, doesn't matter how small it is, or whether you can recognize it, or what part of a song it came from, it's still violating copyright, and you can't do it. And this group called Downhill Battle said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're posting that three-note sample on our site, and we're inviting as many submissions as people will do of 30-minute songs made entirely out of the sound from that sample. 30-second songs entirely from that sample. And they then posted these on the site. They featured some. You could listen to them. And they were amazing. They ranged from the Star Spangled Banner to totally the original creations, basically all of them making the sample so unrecognizable that it's hard to think of that sound source as anything other than a raw material. It's not a matter, you know, you change it that much. So they sort of, they explicitly made the argument that the finding of this court case was unreasonable. And then they did it in a way that showed that they had a lot of support, not just from people who were interested, which they could count by hits on the site, but from people who were actually willing to take the time to make a 30-second song. They didn't change the law. But to me, that was a
type of project that had a huge effect and, in fact, happened in a very short period of time.
So we've come to the end of our hour here, and I wanted to do a little bit of business. But first, thank Rebecca very much for